All right, everybody, we're joined on the phone by Michael Hastings, freelance reporter, friend of the show, and he is the author of the article that's turned Washington, D.C. upside down this week, The Runaway General in Rolling Stone magazine. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm great, man. How are you? Things going, man?
Everything's great. I really appreciate you joining us. You're on the phone from where, Kandahar this morning?
Yeah, I'm in Kandahar right now.
And how's things there?
Well, we just a few, a half hour, 4 minutes ago, we were hit by a number of rockets, which is a pretty regular occurrence here, and there's pretty regular fighting all around this area right now.
Okay, well,
so we spent a couple moments on the floor and then in a bunker.
Jeez, well, and I hope you're bugging out of there this morning and going back to Kabul or somewhere safer.
Yeah, I'm heading out of here.
Okay, right on. Well, in the few minutes before you get in your armored vehicle or whatever it is and get out of there, man, let's talk about, well, first of all, I guess the reaction to your piece. This you have General McChrystal and his team, Team America, his closest buddies surrounding him, really opening up about how much they cannot stand the administration, and that seems to have been the thing that got Washington all upset.
Yeah, apparently, if you criticize and make fun of the vice president in front of a reporter, that's generally probably not a good career move. But I think what some of the, you know, what the comments point to from General McChrystal's view is a real frustration that his team has at the White House, as well as a frustration they have with other civilian policymakers who are involved in the Afghanistan strategy.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what comes across in the article, is that it's not a personal account, really, of McChrystal. It's about his inability to succeed in Afghanistan, and then it seems like all the frustration, all the finger-pointing goes up from there, instead of them taking responsibility, him and his team, America.
Yeah, and I think certainly if we look at, you know, President Obama's role in sort of selecting General McChrystal, why he selects General McChrystal, and what President Obama's strategy for Afghanistan originally was. Remember, in March 2009, you know, President Obama said he wanted to narrow the gains and the goals in Afghanistan, narrow them to just fighting al-Qaeda. Then he selected a general who proceeded to do just the opposite and expand the goals almost exponentially. We went from 50,000 troops to 150,000 troops. We went from fighting al-Qaeda to building a nation on an almost unprecedented scale. So really, I think, you know, part of the story is the relationship between the president and the general, and the fact that the president has just sort of lost control of the policy.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't sound like the troops in Afghanistan seem to be so gung-ho about this anymore either.
No, I think, I'm sure you've discussed counterinsurgency many times on your program. We've discussed it before as well. You know, the U.S. military is made to fight. That's what they're really good at, and they're really efficient at it. And it's very difficult to put them in situations and then tell them, you know, don't fight. And that rubs a lot of them the wrong way, and a lot of them feel that they may have to make sacrifices, and they might be putting their own lives more at risk rather than, say, killing who they view are insurgents.
Yeah, well, and that's an interesting thing, too, the whole, you know, sent out there to fight with one hand tied behind their back. They're up against people who have rifles and are willing to shoot back at them, and yet because they're supposed to be trying to avoid civilian casualties, even though all their enemies are civilians, they're put in a position where they have to get shot rather than shoot.
No, I think, you know, the sort of fundamental flaw with counterinsurgency is that, you know, we spend $600 billion a year in our military, but then we get involved in these wars where we can't even use our technological edge. I mean, in a way, it doesn't make much sense. Once you take away the U.S. sort of ground troops air support, you're putting a U.S. soldier on, you know, a somewhat level playing field with a Taliban fighter. And so these guys who signed up to fight are like, what the hell, you know? Like, why are we here?
Yeah, they imagine they're going to be in a set-piece battle against a different state's military instead of patrolling around like a, you know, SWAT cop or something. Well, now, you talk about how they changed the mission from fighting al-Qaeda to building a nation and how McChrystal's got his stamp on it. And I guess they had to change the mission because he says in here there are no Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the sort of connection between nation building and fighting terrorism, and certainly fighting Al-Qaeda is, I think, you know, a very tenuous connection at best. And so you get stuck with this momentum of the campaign you're fighting. And I mean, it's worse than a quagmire, as I say in the story. It's worse than a quagmire because the quagmire we knowingly walked into. Because if Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan, then what are we doing in Afghanistan?
Yeah. Well, now, the centerpiece of the coin strategy, supposedly, was this, or the showpiece for it, I guess, was the invasion of Marja. They're going to give the people of Marja a government in a box. Did you have a chance to talk with General McChrystal much about that operation?
Well, I did talk to him about that. And he, you know, was sort of optimistically cautious, as that's the sort of position they take. But then, you know, a month later, he said that Marja was a bleeding ulcer. So what does that say? And I think one of the funny things about this story is that people have been saying, wow, how could he have said these things in private to you? And say, well, look what he says in public. He's calling one of his operations a bleeding ulcer. So what do we expect to say in private?
Right, yeah, his centerpiece operation. At least he's bluntly honest, this guy. Well, and look, this is not nothing here. It seems like there is, you know, a challenge to the civilian supremacy in a sense here. You have a very powerful general mocking and ridiculing the president, the vice president, the special envoy, the ambassador, everybody but the Secretary of State, apparently. He thinks he's better than them, and that's really not how it's supposed to be in America. Did you take that as a real challenge to civilian supremacy, or is just some drunk old generals letting off some steam here?
I think there's a larger kind of structural issue here about, you just compare the DOD budget to the State Department budget, $600 billion to $50 billion. You know, you look at the, you know, every foreign service officer, you know, there's more people in the Army band than there are foreign service officers. You know, you could fit every foreign service officer on an aircraft carrier. You know, so you look like just the sort of decay of the State Department, and basically our foreign policy has become our defense policy. You know, the two are one. So, and I think that translates, you know, into the fact that a lot of the times, you know, the leaders get the blame for all the wars, as they should take their fair share of blame. But I think we also have to start looking at the military leaders in a much more critical way than they're accustomed to be looking at.
Mm.
Okay, we're packing up here, and so I gotta take off. But I appreciate that your time, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Likewise. Be safe, and we'll follow up hopefully either tomorrow or Friday or next week.
Cool.
Take care, Michael. All right, everybody, that's Michael Hastings with the story of the week so far in Rolling Stone magazine, The Runaway General.